They'd be making choices. Your Bible's a book full of choices. And they've been doing things and making progress and then seeing needs and the need to make more progress. And it's been a journey. And we've been following some of the different characters who we've identified as exiles. So we're currently thinking of Nehemiah and what happened in his time. So turn to the book of Nehemiah and we'll eventually read some words together. We were introduced to him as a character through the events that surrounded a report that came back from Jerusalem. And it, of course, detailed the state of the city. So although the temple had been rebuilt, the walls of the city were still lying in ruins, and it was a disgrace. And it was an awful slight on the testimony, not of the nation as such, but on the testimony of God. These people who worshipped Yahweh, the living and eternal God, the God of Israel, that here their city was in ruins and it was just a disgrace. And when Nehemiah heard that, he was really moved. And he was driven to fast and to pray, but there was a problem with that because he was the cupbearer or the chief butler to the king. He was afraid that if he was caught on in his fasting and praying that he would maybe lose his job. But he was so concerned with God's glory that it didn't put him off fasting and praying. So our first question that we asked ourselves was this: am I concerned about God's glory? Well, the thing that he feared the most opened up an opportunity for him. And he was able then to ask the king for permission to go and rebuild in Jerusalem. We asked ourselves this question as the story progressed: is my influence positive or negative? Nehemiah obviously had a positive influence in the palace because the king and his wife were going to miss him. But then when he gets to Jerusalem, his influence is also a positive one. And we had to apply that to ourselves in the work of the Lord and in our testimony amongst those that we mingle. Is my influence positive or negative? Then in our last study, we used this question: am I a team player? We are on the winning side and the captain of our salvation is Jesus. And it's a good question to put to ourselves as we live for him. Am I a team player, or is it just all about me, and do I have to get my way, and do I have to make things difficult for everyone else, or am I a team player? Well, this week's question is this: do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? So we're just coming into chapter 3 last time. And I had said that in chapter 3, Nehemiah describes what had happened after the returnees had said, "We will arise and build." That was great to hear that. But what then actually happened? Did they do what they said they would do? Was that promise followed through on? Let us rise up and build. Well, they did. And what we find then in chapter 3 is what I would call a progress report. And in that report, Nehemiah gives the names of the main workers. And with that, he also gives the section of the wall that those named workers were working on. And that's the way we follow right through chapter 3. It appears that none of the returnees had formerly been in the building trade. And one of the things that has blessed us in this fellowship is that those who have done so much of the work have had some skills in the building trade in the past that they could draw. And there were other skills that appeared to the surface that we were unaware of, but that's how things have been working here, and we're glad of that. But it appears that none of the returnees had formerly been in the building trade. They were going to have to learn on the job. In fact, in some cases, many cases, Nehemiah tells us what these workers' former profession or real profession, real qualification was in. And that's why we read Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 1, these words, Nehemiah 3, first verse: "Then Eliashib, the high priest rose up with his brethren the priests, and they builded the sheep gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it, even unto the tower of Mia. They sanctified it unto the tower of Hananiah. So in Nehemiah's progress report, he could just have been very general. He could just have listed the areas that have been repaired without naming anybody in the way that he has done. But I think what he's done here is very deliberate. This is him being very particular, and that's for a reason. He starts at a chosen spot on the city's walls. He could have started anywhere else than this spot, but he starts here. And I think there's a reason for this, and I think we'll see that in a moment or two. So in his progress report, he includes names, he includes former professions, and he starts at a specific spot. And then from that, of course, he goes to each immediately adjacent area and works his way around. Where would you begin if you were going to report? What would be your starting point? What group of people? What area? Eliashib, the high priest, and his brethren, the priests, at the sheep gate. Now, what Nehemiah is telling us here is that they began at the northernmost point of the city of Jerusalem. If you like, if you're looking at the clock, 12 o'clock. They started up there and they were going to make their way in an anti-clockwise direction. So if I'm in front of you and I go clockwise, that'll be anti-clockwise to you. And that'll be right, I hope. There's something like the numbers at the drive-in. I could never get them the right way around. So they started there with the priest and the high priest. A couple of things to note. First, Nehemiah prioritizes the fact that the high priest and his fellow priests got their hands dirty too. But secondly, priests weren't builders. So you have those two things there. So they were going to have to learn on the job. Now, it's okay for quite a number of occupations to just go in and learn on the job. But not for everything. For other jobs, it's required that there be some training. You do a course, you come with a third level qualification and so on. An example is whenever I was very, very young, I worked in a factory, and there was a part of that factory, it was called the trimming line. Now this is up north again. It was the Pruta factory. Do you know what Prutas are? Potatoes. The potato factory. But it made chips. It was really the chip factory. And you imagine the smell of cooking chips all day long. It's actually quite pleasant. It was better than working in Fleming's next door, which was the poultry factory. It was kind of rough. But on that trimming line, all those workers did was look for the potatoes going down that maybe were rotten or had too many black bits. And all you did was you stuck a knife in and that was that. All day long. How long do you think it would have taken you to train to do that? 3 days? 3 weeks? 3 minutes? I'll pray for you, Billy. Well, learning on the job is okay for some things, but I wouldn't like to apply that to a brain surgeon, would you? There you are, there's the knife. Go into the trimming table and do your best. But these guys were having to learn on the job. And it's not just building, it's rebuilding. And I'm sure if you're anything like me, you'd rather do something from new, from scratch, than start to reassemble something that has been broken or has been crumbled down. Isn't it easier to just start? If somebody just came with a lorry load of new blocks and said, right, get on with it, isn't that easier than starting to pick through all the rubble? What a job. But that's what they had to do. Yes, the priest and high priest would have known more about butchery because, of course, they had to serve at the burnt offering altar. But now they're having to learn about building. So Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests get stuck in, they're mentioned first, and that's no mistake. If you think back to Ezra, and we covered this in Ezra chapter 3 and verse 8. This is what we read. Now in the second year of their coming into the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel and Jeshua, do you remember they led that group? They appointed Levites from 20 years old and upwards to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. In other words, I want you guys to set the example. I want you guys to do it first. I want others to see you getting involved first. And of course, you couldn't be a priest without being a Levite. Then much later, when Ezra himself returned, we remembered that there was a period when he stopped before he went on his journey. And we read about this in Ezra 8 and 15. I gathered them together at the river that runs to Ahava, and there abode we in tents 3 days, and I viewed the people and the priests and found none there of the sons of Levi. He's looking for something. Our question then was, would I know if something was missing? So here are people in the rebuilding, and it's important that the priests are involved. So it's no wonder then that Nehemiah begins by drawing attention to the presence of the priests and to the fact that they are involved and that they're setting the example. Well, maybe we're meant to learn from this that even though it was physical rebuilding, that it was a spiritual work. See, physical work, when it comes to the service of the Lord, is a spiritual work. But that's not the only time. The physical work that you do day by day, whatever that is, even if it's just being an at-home grandparent who has to look out for all the family, whatever you have been called to do, it's still a spiritual work, and it should be seen as a spiritual work. Even though you mightn't pray while you're doing it, or you mightn't be singing a hymn while you're doing it, or you mightn't be doing anything that actually is going to contribute to what happens in church, it's a spiritual work. And we sometimes forget that. Paul says in Colossians 3 and 23, whatsoever you do. So that's open, isn't it? Whatsoever you do. Do it heartily. And you know the rest of it. As to the Lord. And not unto men. Now if you're an employee, of course you'll be having to try to do your best for those who are over you. And you will want to do it unto them. But remember that above that, you're doing it unto the Lord. And here's the wonderful key to all this. If you do it as unto the Lord, man will take notice. Man will notice that you're working in a way that is right. And that might even lead them to think of why you work in that way. So our question is, do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? There is a bigger picture. Even in the least task that you might undertake, there is a bigger picture. Verse 2 of Nehemiah 3. And next unto him builded the men of Jericho, and next to them builded Zachar the son of Imri. Now these individuals are identified according to where they were from. They were of Jericho. They weren't just simply Jews or Israelites. They're not described as men of Jerusalem. They are described as men of Jericho. Jerusalem was about, well, between 15 and 18 miles distant from Jericho. Now, nowadays, that's a very short commute, but try walking it. So the workforce from Jericho would have probably had to stay over, and they may have continued for the most of a week, returning just before the Sabbath, and then not leaving again until after the Sabbath. They would have certainly been inconvenienced more than those who were living in and around Jerusalem. So they were committed. Some of these men from Jericho could have said, well, this is not our jurisdiction. But they didn't. They saw the need to share the burden. They saw the bigger picture. And whilst it was inconvenient for them, They had to make a sacrifice. They had to maybe live apart from their families for the most of the week. They did it. Verse 3. But the fish gate that the sons of Hasan-Ea built, who also laid the beams thereof, and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, the bars thereof. And next unto them repaired Merimoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Koz. Next unto them repaired Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Mishez Abiel. And next unto them repaired Zadok, the son of Beanna. And next unto them the Tekoites repaired. And get this little phrase. But their nobles put not their necks to the work of the Lord. Now Nehemiah is definitely using the pen here. He's getting plenty of detail in. He's telling us that, yes, the Tekoites, who had no rank, they got involved. But their nobles did not. They didn't put their neck to the work of the Lord. A commentator suggests that it may be that the people identified as Tekoites were from a district that bordered the region under the governance of Geshem. Now, he was one of the three, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. And they were the three who were opposed, they were the three who mocked, and who were unhappy when they saw the Israelites starting to rebuild again. So, the Tekoites district and area may have bordered that of Geshem. So, for that reason, some commentators suggest that they may have felt pressured to withhold their support, because these border right beside us here. Oh, we'll let the 5/8 go in, but we'll not be seen to be giving our support. And that's not a good enough reason, is it? To not put your neck to the work of the Lord. But another possible reason for the Tekoite nobles to be uncooperative is that their heart wasn't in it. Because there were many of the exiles, as you are aware by now, who could have gone back the first time, but they didn't. Then there was a second opportunity for them to go. They could have gone back then, but they didn't. And Nehemiah was one of those who didn't go back on any of those returns. Now he's going back, but there are still people in Persian-controlled Babylon. And their heart wasn't in it. So it could well be that here are people who, although they did return, yet their heart wasn't in it. Or it could be, and maybe this is the answer that Nehemiah wants us to get, because he's specific in how he describes these people. It could be that they had a problem with pride. It could be that they were happy to let the ordinary 5/8 go and do the work. It could be that this is the culture within that group, that region, governed by the Tekoites. It could be that they let all the ordinary people do all the work and they did nothing. And then this is moving into this very same attitude as they come to the rebuild. This job is beneath us. Well, if you want a job that's beneath you, John Silverson had that. Because he was crawling underneath the floorboards here with data cables the other week. So it definitely was beneath all of us. But thanks to John, it wasn't beneath him. And he got mucky and dirty and all kinds of scrapes down in there. And it's because he has such a slim figure that he was able to do that. You know, for anybody who would be listening to this message and doesn't know anything about Monkstown Baptist Church, we have, in our cleaning rota, we have cleaners who are university lecturers and professors. So if the qualification for our cleaners is such, the pastor must be some guy. And even cleaning isn't beneath them. This is a unique place, isn't it? Are you glad you're belonging to Monkstown Baptist Church? No, dear help us. Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? I think there are times when we do. Is there something you think's beneath you? Or let so-and-so do that, they do nothing else. Is that the attitude? Verse 6. Moreover, the old gate, well, when we get to that, we're now going in a southwesterly direction around the city. The old gate repaired Jehoiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besodeiah, and they laid the beams thereof, and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, the bars thereof. And next unto them repaired Mataliah, the Gibeonite, and Jadon, the Meronothite, and the men of Gibeon and of Mizpah, unto the throne of the governor on this side of the river. Next unto him repaired Uzziel, of the sons of Harhaiah, and of the goldsmiths. Next unto him also repaired Hananiah, the son of one of the apothecaries. And they fortified Jerusalem unto the broad wall. So that's still going in that southern direction around the city. But I'm sure you picked up on a couple of occupations there as I tried to pronounce those words. And there were goldsmiths and apothecaries, really perfumers, who are mentioned there. Again, they're not builders. Their hands wouldn't be used to breeze blocks. They're goldsmiths and perfumers. There are people who had very particular gifts. They had great skills, very unique skills, I would say. Do you know anybody who's a goldsmith? Or do you know anybody who's a perfumer? Rare gifts, very singular gifts, specific gifts. And these were gifts that would have been important in the worship of Israel at that time. Because when we've read about how these folks have returned in different batches, the kings in Babylon, whoever they were quick to send back golden vessels and all sorts of things. So there was, unlike today, where I don't think there's one item made of gold in this building, thankfully, the worship of the temple was very different. It's a very different time. And they had items that were made of gold. They also used incense. They had anointing oil. All of these things were perfumed, were put together in a particular way, and maybe the ingredients that came from the perfumers would be then assembled together by the priests in order to be used to enhance the worship of God. And here they are, with their hands that are used to fine work, lifting blocks. Here they are in construction. Here they are building. But they get on with it. You see, there are tasks that anybody can do and everybody should do. But there are other tasks that only the qualified should do. And in our New Testament, we have that teaching regarding the assembly of God's people, the local assembly. There are things, there are ministries, there are gifts to the church. There are qualifications of deacon, of elder, of pastor, of teacher, and so on. These things are specific. And it's the Holy Spirit who gives the gifts and who qualifies. But then there are things that everybody should be doing. And sometimes it's the qualified for one gift that end up doing the things that everybody should be doing, but everybody doesn't do. Paul writes in Ephesians 4 and 11, the Lord gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers for the perfecting or the maturing of the saints, to the work of the ministry, for the edifying. There's the building up spiritually. We're talking about building walls. This is the spiritual building up, for the building up, edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, unto the complete man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And when he mentions Paul again in 1 Corinthians 14 about seeking spiritual gifts, he says, but seek to excel to the building up of the church. Particular gifts that are important in building up the church. But there are many, many other gifts. Many gifts that everybody can exercise and that everybody has. They're common not in the sense that they're low, because they're all important. And not in the sense that those who use them are any lower than an elder or a pastor, because we're all one in Christ. But they're common in the sense that you don't need a specific qualification. If you're saved by grace and dwelt by the Spirit, then there are things that we should all be doing and that everyone can do. Prayer. Being an encourager. You don't need to be a teacher to pray. And yet that's one of the things we can all do. And here we find these goldsmiths and perfumers doing what everybody can do, even though there were things that were specifically their particular gift. Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? Well, verse 9 says this, next unto them repaired Rephaiah, the son of Hur. I like those wee three-letter names, they're easier to pronounce. The ruler of the half part of Jerusalem, and next unto them repaired Jedaiah, the son of Harumaph, even over against his house. And next unto him repaired Hattush, the son of Hashabniah. We'll go with that. But here's the bit I want you to get. Against his house. Here's more Ulster Scots. We would say fernenced. Against his house. Now that's also repeated in verses 28 and 30, or 28 to 30. You'll find that statement over and over again. Against his house, against his house. A couple of things stand out to my mind there. And that one is that the rebuilding of the testimony of God and the glory of God can start at home. And it did for this man called Rephaiah. It started at home. It could start at home for us. The testimony amongst your neighbours, your family, your workmates. But the neighbour of these men here who may have seen them heading off to rebuild didn't have to look very far because they were right beside them. They knew exactly what they were going to do. It was there. It was obvious. See, so easy for us, isn't it, on a Sunday morning to jump into our car and to drive off, and nobody would know perhaps if we're going to Tesco's or if we're going to church. But there's a testimony to be maintained. Do the folk in the street, would they know as you left the house this morning? They're for church. Because there's so few who actually live right beside the place where the work of the Lord is going on. But you can bring the work of the Lord into your neighbourhood. You can bring the work of the Lord into your neighbourhood by every so often you can go around and put a tract through your door. By speaking to that neighbour who has just moved in and making a contact. There are a myriad of ways in which you can be a missionary right where you are. You can glorify God on your doorstep and in your neighbourhood. Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? But perhaps there's another way that we could interpret those who worked in close proximity to their own house. It could be that they were only going to do what would directly benefit them. That's sad, isn't it? But that's quite often the case. So often it has been in church life, and we often hear this shared with me, that many times parents get involved in Sunday school or in youth fellowship or in youth club while their children are of that age and needing to benefit from that work. But as soon as their children grow up and move away, they're gone. Oh, by the way, I can't help you next year. Doesn't matter about somebody else's kids, somebody else's children. I find a reason why I can't help. But I was able to do it to benefit me, to benefit my youngsters as they grew up. And that's a picture replicated throughout assemblies of all denominations. Because we can be guilty of only ever doing that which benefits us. That's sad. That's not sacrificial. And it may be that this is the message Nehemiah wants to get across. They were happy to do the bit of the wall that they would have to look at every day. But they weren't too worried about the bit of the wall up the road where somebody else was going to have to look at every day. Verse 11. And Malchijah the son of Harim and Hashub the son of Pehath Moab repaired the other piece and the tower of the furnaces or ovens. Now we're being taken by Nehemiah around a part of Jerusalem that is in the south. And it's called the City of David. It's a separate section. It's always identified as the City of David. If you imagine the map of Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day being like a tennis racket, so you have the racket part and then you have the shaft, the handle. Well, the City of David would be like that bottom part. It's a long, narrow piece in the south. So now we're going around that area, the Tower of the Furnaces. And next on to him, verse 12, repaired Shalom, the son of Halohesh, the ruler of the half part of Jerusalem, he and what's decided? His daughters. Oh, dear goodness, woman. He's going to have to mention woman. Well, at least I know what a woman is. Surely not woman. Yes, woman. And it doesn't say that they did anything different here. I want you to get this. Because in the ordinary, plain reading of this verse, it appears that the daughters were involved in exactly what their father, Shalom, was involved in. They were building as well. When I made the announcement of moving the pews, I was very fair. I did say, any good, strong woman, you're welcome to come too. Because there's a queen of women in the church could put me under their arm and run up the road with me. So I was scared not to say the wrong thing. Hasn't happened yet. And here they are, mucking in and involved with all the rest. They were eager, they were willing. And they too could have said, that's no work for me. But they didn't. They got involved. I think of how Paul was so appreciative of the contribution made by women in his day. And we've already come across this in our studies in the book of Acts. Priscilla, the wife of Aquila. And what she did and how she helped them, because they're both mentioned together as having both laid down their necks for the gospel for Paul, and also both mentioned together as having been those who instructed and who taught Apollos, and both mentioned together as being fellow labourers with him in the gospel. In fact, sometimes Priscilla's name is mentioned before that of Aquila. And down through all the thanks that Paul gives at the end of some of his letters, you find the woman mentioned. One thing that stands out to me, when you read about the death of Jesus, and you read about the cross of Jesus, and you read about the resurrection of Jesus, there aren't that many men around in those dangerous hours. But you will read this, and the woman followed. The women were there. Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? You know, our God's a God of variety. This is how you always know a cult or an over-legalistic mindset. They try to make everybody peas in a pod. I don't know what Bible they're reading, because when I read this, I find a massive variety. Even look at the exiles we've been reading about. How diverse they are, how different they are. And our God has made you and I very different. He rejoices in the differences that there are in us. And he can use that to his glory. He doesn't want us to be peas in a pod. We're a family. You show me a family where every one of them's peas in a pod. They might look alike, but you scratch under the surface, you'll discover that they're very, very, very different. Some of you have only had two youngsters, maybe two boys, and they're like chalk and cheese. We have a God of diversity. Well, we're at our time, really. And I think maybe we've said enough. I could without reading right through, give you just one more wee thought, and that's from verse 13 to verse 19, there's one word that keeps reoccurring, and it's the word the ruler, the ruler, the ruler, the ruler, the ruler. And Nehemiah identifies these rulers who also got their hands dirty. Now, they're not priests, they're not goldsmiths, they're not apothecaries, they're not women. They are rulers in, perhaps, they're maybe the remnant of the head of tribes or something like that. There may be officials that have been set up as Ezra was commanded to do. They may be that kind of ruler, we just don't know. But they were people who were in charge of others. They were over others. And they are identified by Nehemiah as such. Do you know what I like? He didn't start his progress report with them. He started with the priests and then made his way on round to them. In fact, they're some of the last almost to be mentioned. Do you know, there are plenty of wee assemblies, and I found this when I lived up and ministered in Kilray. There were a number of little brethren assemblies round us, and there was only maybe two families meeting. Now you imagine that, that's two men, heads of those families. And in some cases it was just a couple of couples. But there are all these wee halls, but they wouldn't come together. They wouldn't unite. And if they did come together, there probably still would only be a meeting of about 25 or 30. But they wouldn't come together. And there's this whole idea, you see, of, well, so-and-so is the leading man. And the leading man wouldn't give up being the leading man. That's why they wouldn't come together. I thought that was sad. And then we watched young family after young family leave, and some came to Baptist churches and pre-Presbyterian and so on. These leading men worked together, and they did what everybody else did. Do I need to be reminded of the bigger picture? We'll end there and ask the Lord to bless these thoughts to all of our hearts for his name's sake.